I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Trump administration was told by a judge more than a year ago to end its zero-tolerance policy that automatically separated children from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border and to reunify those families. The ACLU, in a recent court filing, says that more than 900 children have been separated from their parents since the policy was supposed to be stopped, with the government saying that two-thirds of those separations were because of crimes committed by the parents. Now, the ACLU charges the government isn't making a distinction between misdemeanors like driving without a license and dangerous behavior that could harm a child. We asked Lee Gelernt to join us. He's an attorney, also the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrant Rights Project. He's also an adjunct professor at Columbia University. And Lee Gelernt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Is the Trump administration violating this judge's court order?
We believe that the administration is violating the court order and basic constitutional due process standards. The law is very clear. You take a child from a parent only if the parent is genuinely unfit or truly a danger to their child. We were shocked to find out that they are separating parents and children for misdemeanors. In one case, destruction of property for $5, a misdemeanor committed years ago. As you said, traffic offenses. So we have filed a motion and we will be back in court on this issue.
There was even a case of a parent, I think it was a father, who didn't change his child's diaper. The child was sleeping, had a soiled diaper, and somehow got in trouble for that.
Right. And so we've put in an enormous amount of evidence showing what's been happening. This was a father whose child was very sick. The detention center knew that the child was very sick. The child finally fell asleep. The parent made the decision that most parents would have made to allow the child to continue sleeping and change the diaper after the child woke up so the child could get to sleep. Some guard who's not a child expert came over and said, "You should have woken your child up," and just took the child away, a little child, and took it away from the parent. Took the child away from the parent. I mean, the stories are shocking. You know, we are now in a situation where the 900 may already be 1,000 since the data is about a month old. We could be looking at basically the next round of family separation, notwithstanding, as you said, a court halting the policy last summer.
Let me follow up on a couple of things. First of all, do we know, is that child still separated from his or her dad?
Oh, that's a good question. And we are trying to find out about whether all these children are still separated. We believe overwhelmingly they are. But I'm glad you asked that, because that is another problem. I mean, it's not just that the standards they're using to take children away are unconstitutional and violate the court's order, but we are not getting any information about these separations. The parent and child are not being given full information about why they are being separated. They're not giving a process to push back. They're not giving information about how to reunify if the separation is ultimately deemed to be unlawful. And so we are still looking into all these cases about where the children are.
What would be the options? I mean, would they be in one of these facilities that we have seen along the U.S.-Mexico border, or even some facilities that we've seen, or a privately run facility in Florida? Is that where you imagine some of these children might be?
We don't know. We believe that they are spread all over the country, and I would say that the conditions in the children's facilities vary widely. Some are horrendous, some are comparatively better. But what we have always said to the court and what the judge understands is, even if the children are sent to palaces, it's the fact of separation that causes so much trauma to these children. And as the medical community has pointed out, potentially permanent trauma to these children. So the government has tried to make a big deal of saying, well, most of the children go to facilities that are not so bad. And what we've said is some of the facilities are so bad, but that's really besides the point. It's taking a child away from a parent. And what we've also found out is this latest round of separations after the court halted the policy, These are younger children than the first time around last summer. 20% are under five. That's almost 200 kids under five have been taken away for the most minor offenses of their parent. And so the government knows full well that their facilities are not equipped to handle little babies and toddlers. And so no matter how good the objective features of the facility may look from the outside, there's simply no way they can handle the emotional trauma these kids are suffering.
No question. When you talk about these minor offenses, is there some kind of criteria or written descriptions that if a parent engaged in this kind of behavior, they could lose, if not custody, certainly access to their children?
Right. So I think that's the important question. The judge was very clear and said, look, you know, if the parent is genuinely a danger or unfit, and that's the standard that's used by all states, and there is an enormous body of law that's developed over time, and everyone, there are some gray areas, but everyone has come to understand that it means you're posing an imminent danger right. to the child,
right.
not that you have some past crime, but we're the government has taken a position that any crime, no matter how insignificant now, is a basis to take the child away. So there is an enormous gulf between our position and what we think the law is and what the government's position is. And it's going to have to be hammered out in court. Because if you were in, can you imagine in a state in Pennsylvania where the state of Pennsylvania said, we're going to take your child away mm-hmm. because we heard you had a misdemeanor offense years ago. It's only where the parent is really posing an imminent danger to the child, you know, that is beating the child, is neglecting the child so severely, those types of things. Now, I mean, if they took children away from parents in the United States for traffic offenses or misdemeanor offenses, can you imagine millions of parents would be losing their children? Their children would be going to foster care. So that's just not the law. The government's trying to get away with it in the immigration system. And like we did last summer, we hope to put a halt on this.
So then is the zero tolerance policy, is that still essentially then in effect? We might not call it that, but in the final analysis, that's still the policy.
Right. So I think what it is the government trying to do this through the back door. The government, the court laid down an exception if the child was genuinely in danger, and instead of treating that as the narrow exception it was intended to be, the government has essentially driven a truck through it, and so they're doing family separation just by another name.
Do we know, and this goes back more than a year, this policy was supposed to be stopped more than a year ago, but do we know how many children have been reunified with their family since that time?
So there are basically three groups of families now, which is what we've learned. Last summer, what we call the initial group that was involved in the court case was about 2,800. We have managed the court case to give every one of them an opportunity to reunite, with a few exceptions where the parent is in jail. So that group, we thought, we had hoped that was sort of the end of it. But now it turns out there are two other groups. One group is backward looking. It's before the zero tolerance policy. At the beginning of the Trump administration, it turns out that there were thousands of families potentially separated then, which was only revealed through an internal government report. We've gone back to court and said we need a list of all those families who were separated who were never reported to the court or the ACLU. We are slowly on a rolling basis getting a list of those names. It's already close to 1,000. We are in the process of trying to contact all those families all over the world. That's going to be an enormous task, so we don't know how many of those families are reunited. We suspect most of them are not reunited. And then there's this forward-looking group after the injunction, the 900-plus. We don't know how many of those families are reunited, but we suspect most of them are not. So we have our work cut out for us. I think after last summer, we had hoped we had put an end to it, but it now turns out that there were many more that were never reported, and the administration's continuing to do it.
I have a couple more questions before we have to say goodbye to you. Did the Obama administration have a similar policy? That is something the Trump administration has said.
Yeah, they did not, and that's completely wrong. What the Obama administration, like every other administration, had was we'll take the child away if we see objective evidence that the child is genuinely in danger. That's the same as what states would do. And so very, very rarely was a child separated, and only where the child was really in danger. So it was a few children here or there, and those were hopefully only where there was real objective. And so there was no policy of systemically taking away children, systematically taking away children. It's simply wrong that any other administration has separated thousands of children. This was a practice done by the administration in order to try to deter Central American asylum seekers from coming to this country. What the administration thought was, well, if we make it so ugly for these families, take away even their babies, maybe they won't come. And obviously that's wrong, because if a family is in such danger, they're going to come anyway. But the other thing I think I would say is, even if it were a deterrent, there's some things in the United States we simply don't do. And that's why I think you saw everybody from the Pope to Laura Bush to religious leaders from all different faiths pushing back on it.
We don't, I mean, the idea is we don't punish children.
Exactly.
Let me ask you, and I think we're all, one of the reasons we wanted to do the show was the sobbing children, frankly, in Mississippi last week as a result of an ICE raid. They didn't know where their parents were. One little girl in particular was crying for her father. I'm just curious to you, Lee, as you look at that, is that also sort of a piece of this whole conversation?
I think it is. It's a slightly different piece, but I think it is. It's this whole notion that the administration claims they're only going after hardened criminals or national security threats, but then you see who they actually are going after. And we don't know that any of those families had criminal histories. They just went after them because they were here. They were undocumented. But the toll is so enormous on these families. I think that's why administrations in the past have exercised more discretion to say, well, look, who are we actually going to go after? Are we going to cause this much hardship in communities and to families? And so I think that the administration claiming that they only go after hardened criminals and national security threats is not true. And Mississippi was an example of this, little kids asking, where are their parents? Where are their parents?
Lee, we're about 30 seconds. So looking at these children that were separated, it's really the court that will make the next determination?
We're hoping the administration changes their policy on their own, but we're not holding our breath, so it will be the court.
Well, I always appreciate you joining us on Radio Times, even though it's a really hard conversation to have.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. That's Lee Gallant. Again, he's an attorney and the deputy director of the ACLU's Immigrant Rights Project. He's an adjunct professor at Columbia University and has been trying to find all these children that have been separated from their parents. We're going to take a very short break and shift gears slightly. We'll be talking about Berks Center here in Pennsylvania, the numbers of family members who are being held there. And we'll be talking more about the impact of our immigration policy on children. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. I'm Artie Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The Berks Family Residential Center in Pennsylvania is one of three facilities in the country that keeps immigrant families together. It used to be a nursing home, has nearly 100 beds, and as of this week, houses 14 parents and children seeking asylum. It's run by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, that has a contract with Berks County that reportedly abides by state regulations. There is pressure on Governor Wolf to shut the facility down. A local county commissioner has said it should be closed. And a group of Pennsylvania psychologists and psychiatrists determined that Berks is harmful to children's mental and physical health. Today, as we discuss the impact of our immigration policies on children, we focus on Berks. And joining us by telephone is Madeline Dean. She's a congresswoman, Democrat from Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District, and she visited Berks on July 21st. Madeline Dean, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
With us here in our Philadelphia studios is Bridget Cambria, and she's a pro bono lawyer at ALDEA, the People's Justice Center. In fact, she co-founded it a couple of years ago, and they represent most of the families at Berks. And Bridget, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And Allison Mackey is with us as well. She's an assistant professor of psychology and a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania. She is one of the psychiatrists from Pennsylvania who raised a host of concerns about the treatment and the mental health status of children who are at Berks. And I should add that, nice to have you with us, Allison, as well. And I should add that ICE declined our invitation to be a guest. They did send a statement that I will read just a bit later in the show. Madeline Dean, let me begin with you. You made a surprise visit July 21st. I know that previously you had visited detention facilities in Texas and in Florida. Why surprise?
Because I was aware that when we went to both El Paso and Homestead and Clint detention centers, we had to be pre-cleared. They needed about 2 weeks advance notice for members of Congress to come. I thought that was utterly inappropriate. We didn't want to see a sanitized version of what was going on, which is clearly what we did see in both Texas and in Florida. We wanted to see it in real time. And so I invited Mary Gay Scanlon, a new representative with me, a freshman with me, who's on Judiciary Committee with me, to go to Berks County to see for ourselves.
And were you able to have access to the full facility?
Yes, we were. There was some delay. They were surprised that we were there. But very quickly, the executive director who runs it for the county talked to the folks of ICE. There was some delay. It took about a half an hour of dilly-dallying. I'm not sure what that was about. Before we got in, we were able to see the facility, and I had seen it before as a state representative last year. We were mostly interested in speaking to the families who were there, and that's what we did. We spent the better part of an hour and a half, I suppose, sitting at sort of picnic bench tables inside, talking to mothers, fathers, and their young children about what they had escaped and what they were enduring in this detention center.
Well, what did they tell you about Berks then?
First, what they told us about what they escaped, and one man that was very badly beaten in Mexico 8 days prior. And when he came across the border at Douglas, he and his son were shackled. The son showed us the marks still on his arms from the shackling at the border with the United States, and then they were shipped up here. Many of them were fleeing for their lives. Many of them were crying, sad, fearful. Some were taken not from the border, but from interior sites, one in Philadelphia, one in Los Angeles, people who had been living here for a number of years, and processing through the asylum system. But they were, in fact, taken as a result of the President Trump's orders for surprise taking of folks. At Berks, the conditions look okay. But one of your guests who's sitting there educated me, Bridget, the advocate and attorney who's extraordinary. While it may look okay, this is doing permanent harm to children. As she says, a golden cage is still a cage. These children are fearful for what they fled and fearful for where they are. They talk about being awakened every 15 minutes by flashlights in their rooms. They're not satisfied with the food. It is sometimes cold and not appropriate for them and perhaps not enough. They were told that we were told that it is a non-secure facility, that they could go in and out as they please. They said that was not the case. So it was just, to me, utterly dissatisfying that we're in the business of detaining children at all.
Let me just read what we got from ICE. I can't read the whole thing, but just a couple of sentences. The Berks Family Residential Center will continue to provide a safe and humane environment for families as they go through the immigration process. The center operates in an open environment, includes playrooms, social workers, educational services, resident field trips, and access to legal counsel. Let me get Bridget Cambria and also Allison Mackey in on the conversation here. But Bridget, you were listening intently as Madeline Dean was describing Berks, a place you were familiar with. In fact, you started ALDEA in response to the fact that there wasn't legal representation largely at Berks.
That's correct. ALDEA, the People's Justice Center, provides pro bono legal services to any family that wants it in the facility. But believe me, our legal access is not open and unfettered. There are lots of obstacles to provide legal access to the families there, and we work very hard to get into the facility to provide those legal services every single day. But that is because we've decided to do that. We've not been invited by immigration to come into the facility to help the families who are there. But every family that's there desperately needs legal services, because the purpose of the facility is not to keep a family together while they're going through an immigration process. The purpose is to bring families into the center and deport them as fast as possible. That's why the center is there. The center is there to basically keep a family for the time that it takes for them to deport them. That's the only purpose of the facility. They're not there for the entirety of a case. They're not there because they have nowhere to go. The only reason that families are brought to the center is that immigration wants to deport them quickly.
Let me a couple of questions, and then, Allison, I'll get you in on the conversation. When I wrote up my intro a couple of days ago, I had something like 26 parents and children. You told me this morning they're now 14. So where did those 12 people go?
For the most part, only because legal services are provided, the majority of families are released into the community, into the interior of the United States, because we're successful in their cases. Either we have argued that the families have a credible fear of persecution, and for that reason they should be permitted to enter the United States and seek asylum. We have been successful at taking families who enter the facility from a raid and have an order of removal that maybe they don't even know about, and reopen those proceedings so that they can, again, go in front of a judge and have a fair proceeding where they can seek asylum. We even have families who come into the facility who are part of the Remain in Mexico program, which is a travesty on the border right now.
Where they have to stay in Mexico to ask for asylum.
And we're working very hard to keep those families here in the United States and not permitting them to be returned to Mexico. And unfortunately, there are families who are deported so quickly that we don't have an opportunity to get to them or to overturn their case, or it's just so difficult. But the purpose of the facility is when you enter that facility, it's either you're deported or you win some sort of legal battle, and that's the only way you get out.
Allison, let me get you in on the conversation. I was talking initially with Lee Gallant about children who are being separated from their parents and the kind of emotional hardship one can only imagine a child goes through under those circumstances. But you're part of a group of psychologists and psychiatrists in Pennsylvania that said even Berks, where families are together, that Berks is not good for children. In what way?
What I worry about is the intense fear that they're feeling. Right? So when the brain is experiencing fear, the fear circuitry gets stronger and stronger, and the prefrontal areas of the brain that are meant to control fear get weaker and weaker. And that can give rise for any number of mental health risks as well as physical health risks. So a repeated exposure to stress gives rise to risk for basically any condition you can think of. So that's anxiety, that's depression, but it's also things like heart disease and Alzheimer's.
I wonder, though, I mean, these are people, these are families looking for asylum. So mm-hmm. they have fled dangerous communities, situations to come to the United States. Do we know that if we're looking at the impact of a place like Berks on a child's development, can we separate what they came from and the kind of impact of living under that kind of danger and stress versus what they're experiencing at Berks?
There's actually some evidence that this sort of multiple hit model being stressed over and over again is worse than any specific stressor on its own. And I think also they're not getting the services that could potentially reverse some of those stresses. So we do know that there is plasticity or changeability in mm-hmm. the brain, and that returning to a stable, loving, nurturing environment can undo some of that stress.
If a parent is a loving parent at Berks, mm-hmm. Can they mitigate some of that by being that caring parent?
Absolutely. Parents act as buffers. Kids need parents. If you look at what are called ACEs or adverse childhood experiences, over half of those are about disruption to stable care. And so if children have their parents, they can tolerate much more stress, but still that fear will impact them.
Madeline Dean, let me go back to you. Should Berks be closed? And a number of people have called for that.
I think it should be, and you saw that the Wolf administration has been working on this.
Right.
He put out a letter to DHS acting secretary, I guess it was yesterday, He reiterates the request, you know, that these families be put in community settings. So I believe they should not be there. What the professor was just talking about, you could see that in the children's faces. They are fearful for what they left, and they're fearful for where they are. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the saddest things to recognize in their eyes and in their conversation, the fear under which they are currently living. What to me, you know, and I purposely wanted to go to Berks to see what was going on in Pennsylvania, because I had been on July 1st to El Paso, where I saw women being detained in jail cells, women who had been held for 56 days under inhumane treatment. Mm. They had been in some temporary facilities outside, brought in only that day, and were literally in a 10 by 13 cinder block cold jail cell with a stainless steel toilet with no running water in the sink, and were told to drink out of the toilet. Why I mention that is I wanted to compare and contrast, of
sure.
course. But notice the inhumanity of that. And that's what the women said to us. We don't mind if we are called names. We mind being treated like dogs. The inhumanity of the detention of whether it's adults, we also went to Clint, where we saw separated children behind thick glass jail doors trying to beam fearfully kind of at us. We tried to holler through to say who we are. What I saw was the inhumanity of the treatment of these people. They are people. And the humanity of the children trying to communicate with us.
It's
and then I also had been to Homestead on July 2nd, the next day, where 2,300 separated children were being held for profit. 2,300. And when I talked to the director of the children's portion of this in a judiciary hearing, our administration, who put this policy in place, they do not know how many children they have separated from their families. They do not know how many children were detained before or were separated before the zero tolerance policy. They don't even know how many they did under the zero tolerance policy. And we couldn't get a clear answer to, is it continuing?
I mean, it's just shocking.
So it's shocking. And it's, if the administration doesn't get the inhumanity of it, which it apparently doesn't, they should get the incompetence of it. It's utterly incompetent on an administrative level that you don't know where these children are. And to see the profound fear, this is immediate, imminent harm. They are punishing these families, whether it's at Berks or in these other detention centers. It's grotesque.
Bridget Kimry, let me go back to you. And we were talking about this actually before going on the air. If Berks were closed, what would happen, I guess, to the people who generally get sent there? Would they be sent to another facility, or do we know what that process might be, or would they be sent back to where they came from?
No, and this is the number one question that we get as advocates who ask that perhaps the Berks County Residential Center should be closed. What will happen to the families?
Sure.
Every family that has been in that center, I'd say 99% of them, come to the United States because this is where they have family, this is where they're safe. So each of them have a place and a sponsor to go within the United States, a community that's willing to receive them and to care for them. That's where they would go. By and large, anyone who's seeking asylum in these facilities upon release are released to the interior, into the arms of a family member, into a welcoming home. That's where they would go. There is only one other center in the entire country which accepts families, and that's in Texas. There is no transfer between those mm-hmm. facilities mm-hmm. and Berks. If people leave, they leave into the community.
But we're talking about an asylum policy that was changed. I mean, how do you keep up with that?
It's very
coming from the Trump administration.
It's very
obviously.
Difficult as a legal practitioner to keep up with that. But the baseline remains: every person who comes to the United States out of fear seeking protection has the right to request asylum. And they have a process that they get to enter, whether it's got a million hurdles in front of it, they still can access that process. And that's the job as us as attorneys. And there are attorneys nationwide that are battling every single day to open that process to every single, especially child, especially family who is seeking it.
Let me read a couple of... Yeah, go ahead, Madeline Dean.
Mind- asking Bridget about, I'm just amazed at her heroic work, she and the team of lawyers. After Mary Gay Scanlon, Representative Scanlon and I left the center, there were some strange movement of some of the families, some of the parents and children. And we don't know if it was in response to our being there, mm-hmm. but could you describe just some of the legal hoops you had to jump through to get those families back to Berks?
Sure. So after the congresswomen left the facility within days, ICE in the facility embarked on a pattern of trying to remove families from the facility who had talked to the congresswoman. It's just either a coincidence of timing or the families had felt themselves it was punitive. And I think it was just a matter of the timing. But what
and they were being watched. I mean, this is a public place, so people knew that they were talking to the
That's correct. And they even indicated that while they were talking to the congresswoman, someone was there taking notes. And that sort of has raised intimidation within the facility. But there were three particular families who immigration went to extremely great lengths to try and remove from the United States. Each of the families were currently seeking help from courts within the United States. Two of the families had stays of removal that were granted by a court, which means they were not allowed to be moved. Right. They were not allowed to be deported. ICE moved them anyway. In one other case, we had that stay request pending, and normally ICE will inquire with the court what their intent is before they remove them. They did not in this case. In none of the cases were we advised that they planned on moving children at all. So in those cases, while families were being taken, in one case, all the way across the country to San Diego to be sent into Mexico, we had to enter two federal courts, and we had to also embark on the appeals court in the immigration system to get them to order all of the families back. So they have all been ordered back into the facility, and they cannot be moved now.
We're talking about Berks in Berks County here in Pennsylvania. Madeline Dean, can you stay with us for a couple of more minutes?
I can. I'd be pleased to.
Okay, and that's U.S. Representative Madeline Dean. Also with us, lawyer Bridget Cambria and psychologist Allison Mackey. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and in this hour of Radio Times, we are talking about the U.S. immigration policy, its impact on children, focusing on Berks Family Residential Center, which is here in Pennsylvania. It's one of the few facilities in the country that keeps immigrant families together. They are seeking asylum here in the United States. Madeline Dean, U.S. Representative, a Democrat for Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District. She sits on the Judiciary Committee, and she was at Berks on July 21st. Bridget Cambria, pro bono lawyer with ALDEA, People's Justice Center, and it's an organization of lawyers that she co-founded to deal with Berks. Also with us is Allison Mackey. She's an assistant professor of psychology and a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, one of a number of psychologists and psychiatrists who determined in a report that Berks is harmful to children's mental and physical health. A lot of people that want to join us. And let me just get you, Allison, back in on the conversation. Again, listening to what life is like in Berks for children. What are the concerns you have if someone is a young child versus someone who might be a 17-year-old teenager?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't think we fully know the answer. So I think there's some evidence that the younger a child is, the more sensitive they are to stress, but I don't think that there's a safe age for stress. There's lots of evidence that adolescence becomes a second sensitive period, but we see these effects in adults as well.
Well, I would think adolescents are adolescents, right? They kind of want to be on their own. They want to sort of create their own separate identity, often from their family, from their parents, and yet they're in a sense stuck together.
I guess I would still see their parents as that safe home base. So having that safety and security of a nurturing, loving relationship allows them to take safe risks and sort of build their personality and their identity in a safe way. And so I don't think that there's any reason that you would want to separate adolescents from their parents.
And I'm thinking also of just once they leave, what that process is. Let's say they go to a loving family that's here in the United States, that process of reentry for that child.
I imagine it would involve some therapy, high-quality education, allowing them to build the skills that they need to succeed here. Their brains are very much still plastic and open to these positive experiences as well.
And so a positive experience afterwards can help address whatever stress and trauma they might have experienced.
Absolutely.
Madeline Dean, there is pressure on Pennsylvania Governor Wolf to close Berks. There are folks that are talking about an emergency removal order. At this point, it seems that he hasn't made the move yet. But what do you anticipate for closing Berks? Does it come through ICE? Does it come through the governor? Does it come through Berks County commissioners?
I think it's a combination, likely, of everybody with the exception of ICE. I don't think ICE shows any interest in stopping what they're doing there. But certainly the county, the governor, advocates, these lawyers and Congress people who are calling for it. I've been in touch with the governor's policy secretary. They are actively working on this. You may know that the licensing for that center is for children only, so it's already outside the scope of its license, and that is a matter that is being litigated because it was not meant for families, strangely. So it's being used in a way that was not licensed. I know that the administration wants to bring an end to it, and I've had very minimal discussions with them over the legal complications of that. But I've tried to say to them, if you need to prove imminent harm, immediate harm, speak to people like Allison Mackey. Speak to others who are experts that identify the detention of children, no matter where it is or how it is, in this way as immediately and imminently harmful. One of the things that the family said over and over to us, and I was very lucky to have Matt Bieber translate, a person who works on my team, translate what the families were saying, was they came here believing they would be welcomed. To a person, that's what they thought America would represent, welcome from the fear and the harm and the traumas they were suffering. It turned out they got nothing like welcome. That, to me, is evidence of the immediate harm, that these children are saying they're fearful. They're fearful as they sit there. So I hope, and I really have faith, that the governor and his team are doing what they can to bring this to a close.
Well, Madeline Dean, I appreciate you joining us on Radio Times, once again talking about children and our immigration policy. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And you're very welcome. She's U.S. Representative for Pennsylvania's 4th Congressional District, a first-time Democrat in the U.S. Congress. Let me read a couple of comments here. And Bridget Cambria with Aldea staying with us for the rest of the hour. Allison Mackey, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, also staying with us for the rest of the hour. One from Kristen: who is in charge of oversight of these detention facilities? Who's allowing these separations to happen if they violate the court order? This probably goes back to our first guest, Lee Gelernt from the ACLU. But nonetheless, who has, I guess, responsibility for Berks? Is it the county? Is it the state? Is it the federal government?
That's a very good question. Oversight in the facility is something that would be done internally. It would be done by the Department of Homeland Security through the Office of Inspector General. Additionally, I do believe that the state, through the Department of Human Services, does conduct inspections within the facility. We always question as to the sufficiency of those inspections because routinely our families are not spoken to. The children are not inquired with as to how they're doing. We have the honor, the Berks County Residential Center, of the only sexual assault that was actually proven in a family detention center. That occurred here in...
You proved it, right?
Well, the staff member who sexually assaulted a mother within the facility was arrested and convicted. However, the state never did any kind of investigation into that. So if that isn't a violation, what is? So to be honest, the sufficiency of the inspections within the facility is something that we question because it does not take into account the effects of detention on children. It doesn't take into account anything besides what you see visually. We need to really be looking at what detention is doing to the families and the kids who are in there, what that means, what effects it has, why it's harmful. That's what really needs to be investigated.
Allison, we were talking about stress and trauma. What about boredom? What is the effect of boredom on a developing child?
Boredom can be devastating. So we think about boredom as a form of cognitive deprivation. you need as a child to have cognitive stimulation, to have high-quality education, to have access to play and games, social support. Those are the things that drive the development of the brain. And it doesn't sound like they're getting that.
Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Most of the children in the facility, one of their greatest complaints is that they just want to leave because they don't know what they're doing with their day. They're constantly fearful. They watch their friends get taken out of the facility at 3 in the morning. It terrifies them. All they want to do is leave. And they keep asking their parents over and over again. This is something you said, Allison, that having your parent with you is sort of comforting. But in the Berks County Residential Center, the parent isn't really a parent. They're really a babysitter. They're watching their own child. They have no authority over where their children are, what they're doing, when they wake up, when they go to sleep, what they eat, whether they get medical care. All of those decisions are made for them. So what you actually see is children regress. You see children actually start to disrespect their parents because they know their parents aren't the ones that make the decisions. So it really affects the ability for a parent to be a parent, and there's really nothing more devastating to a mother than to lose complete control of their child. It's something that affects the parental relationship for the rest of their lives.
I would think a father would feel the same way.
Father would feel the same way. Yes.
Anything you want to add to that, and then we'll get Steve from Reading to join us.
I think the autonomy of parents is critical, and I hadn't really thought about what that would mean to the parent and what that would mean for the child in terms of who they see themselves being as an adult, right? I think it must impact their beliefs about what the world is like forever.
And the idea that, you know, children often idealize their parents. I mean, you know, they're the ones that brought them into the world. They're protecting them, taking care of them. And I'm assuming these are parents who have traverse the most sort of dangerous environment to get to the United States. So you've got that kind of a parent, too, and to lose that kind of autonomy.
And their belief is that they've brought them to the United States to save them. So when they realize that, when they watch their kids suffer, they question themselves, like, have I done the right thing? Like, have I just taken my child from one traumatic experience to another? And they start to self-hate.
Let me get Steve from Reading to join us. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm going. I'm a pastor in Reading, and my church has been involved with the detention center probably 15 or 16 years. And the first time we were involved, it was because of a member of my church was a translator for a family from the Congo. And I was allowed to go into where they were staying and see their conditions. We were allowed to assist them in finding an apartment. We helped them get started, and they're still in the area living well. Over the years, we helped, we provided money for holiday meals through a couple of activists in the local area. Crystal Kowalski is one of them. And then this past December, I went and helped serve the meal since we were providing it. I wanted to see what was going on myself. And there has been a change in the way that families are treated. I was allowed to go into where they ate, and they seemed healthy. I don't know if they were happy or not, but they seemed healthy enough. I wasn't allowed to see where they stayed. I had to be given permission, even though I'd been there in the beginning, 15 years, 16 years ago. So there is a change, and it's become more of a prison and less of a place where they could feel safe.
Well, Steve, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. I'm looking at you, Bridget. Does that, I mean, here's someone that can really compare 15 years ago to today.
Yes. Yeah, so the center has been around since 2001. At that time, it held both families and unaccompanied minors. There was a shift. And then there's always a shift, I feel like, almost every year with who's being detained there, what's happening. They've certainly become more restrictive now just because eyes are on the facility. Right. They do not, you know, because the facility is operated and they make a profit off of it, it's something that's very protective. So a lot of people ask, well, how can I volunteer in the center? And they never accept volunteers, very few, very specific people they allow into the facility. It's very guarded. It's also the only facility where families can be there for an indeterminate amount of time. So we've had,
even with children,
even
who are
with
not
children.
Supposed to be held for, what, more than a couple of weeks, right?
That's correct. We've had children in that facility for 2 years. 2 years unable to leave the facility. Imagine a child being stuck in one building, five rooms, for 2 years, and what that does to them. So this is the only facility in the entire nation where that's even possible. It's also the only facility in the entire nation where they do these 15-minute bed checks, which we find very problematic. Sleep's extremely important for children. So imagine a child being woken up 40 times a night.
Because someone put a flashlight in their eyes, right?
Exactly. Well, in their eyes, at the ceiling, what happens is you open the door, you walk into the room, you disrupt the sleep, you wake up, imagine, 40 times a night. The kids that were there 2 years, we did the math. It was somewhere around 30,000 sleep interruptions. It's just the way that this facility is run, the secrecy of it, the fact that they try to make it seem good, when really we should be looking at: is this the state that we want? Is this what we want to be as Pennsylvanians? Do we want to encourage the detention of children here in this state?
Well, I'm thinking about sleep deprivation and, you know, developing young brains. Allison.
Absolutely. There's evidence that one night of sleep disruption for an adult disrupts emotion regulation circuitry. So the connections between prefrontal cortex for cognitive control and the amygdala for emotion, that happens in one night for adults. I can't even imagine what that's going to look like for children. Obviously, we can't study that.
Right?
That's not the sort of thing that's a normative experience that we could look at. But we do know that sleep disruption in childhood is associated with all sorts of mental and physical health problems.
Here's a tweet. Isn't part of the problem the fact that we have tasked law enforcement agencies with juvenile and family care? I mean, the idea that, you know, they're not trained to deal with all these psychological issues we've been talking about.
That's exactly the question that needs to be asked. And the reason is that if you look at unaccompanied minors, they specifically were taken out of the supervision of ICE. So they are watched and evaluated by the Office of Refugee Resettlement under the Department of Health and Human Services. Families are not. So families are watched by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So the people that care for families are the same people that deport them. So there's that adversarial situation that's going on inside the facility. So inside Berks, it's not just staff members from Berks County. ICE is in the same building. So children watch their deporters every day. And they watch those people, the same people, take out their friends and families from the facility. So they're constantly scared.
Because they're seeing their friend, you know, their compatriot, their fellow student, I guess.
Sure. Somebody you rode bikes with or were on the swings with yesterday is taken out crying and screaming, and the effects that that would have on a child.
Allison, go ahead.
Absolutely. So it's not just about your own family, right? So stress is somewhat contagious. If we look at our checklist for child stress, it's did anybody that you love experience these kinds of things? And so I think the unpredictability of that makes it difficult to form those social attachments in the first place.
So we're almost out of time here. An email from Kristen. What can we do to help? Bridget?
Well, I think the way that you help is to stay involved, to stay vocal. I'm inspired by the advocates in this city and the advocates in the Berks County area and, in fact, throughout Pennsylvania who have finally brought this issue into the public. We see people walking through the streets of Philadelphia in marches with signs that say, shut down Berks. I mean, that to me is incredible, because who knew that we had a family detention center in Pennsylvania? When did you figure that out? Probably wasn't that long ago. The facility's been here for 15 years. Kids have been struggling for 15 years. So the way that you stay on top of it is to stay involved, go to marches, participate, donate to a great legal services organization. Just stay involved.
Well, Bridget Cambria, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. A pro bono lawyer with Aldea, I should say. She co-founded Aldea, the People's Justice Center, and has been working with families at Berks. Allison Mackey, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. She and a number of other psychologists and psychiatrists in Pennsylvania have said that Berks is hazardous to children's mental and physical health. We did ask a representative from ICE to join us. They declined our invitation, and they did send us a statement, part of which I read. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us.